There are parts of the gospel story that we just heard that might immediately stand out for their drama, and rightfully so. There's Jesus transformed and bright. There's Elijah and Moses suddenly. And then there's that voice of God declaring who Jesus is. But amidst all that drama, this week I found myself drawn to the aftermath, when in some ways the world goes back to normal. And the disciples are just there with Jesus, the Jesus that they know. The Jesus who touches them and gets them back on their feet. I wonder what exactly that looked like. My first inclination was to imagine a hand softly laid on the shoulder of each, but then I remembered that the logistics are more complicated because the disciples are laying out on the ground. So maybe Jesus kneeled in front of them, rested a hand on top of their outstretched ones, one by one by one. I don't know what it looked like, but I know that touch is a powerful thing. Unfortunately, we have to acknowledge that touch can be powerful in negative ways at times, abused and misused. But on the other side, touch can bring life, helping the overwhelmed stand back up again. One of the most beautiful aspects of our faith is that God, through Jesus Christ, really actually touched people. And not just in the metaphorical, metaphysical kind of way. I wonder, in whatever season of life you find yourself in right now, which desire pulls more strongly on your heart? To see the sparkling, radiant glory of Jesus inspiring you to exclaim, like Peter, "Lord, it is good for us to be here." Or to see Jesus no longer glimmering, but looking like someone you might pass on the street, looking like a friend, a neighbor, a loved one, and to feel him touch you and say, "Get up and do not be afraid," inspiring you to peel yourself up off of the ground. There isn't a right or wrong answer to that question. Both desires count and can even exist together. But I thought it might be helpful to name them as distinct experiences of God, both fully divine but different in feeling and effect. Just as the presence of God changes in feel and look over the course of one gospel passage, so does our experience in seeking after God change throughout the course of our lives. Now, one of these desires might feel flashier and the other more grounded, but both can seem like they're far from being met in our lives today. Sure, the no longer shining Jesus is more relatable, but even he may seem impossible to touch. If we're feeling that sense of distance, we have a perfect text to turn to in today's reading from 2 Peter. Now, 2 Peter is a bit complicated because a lot of scholars suggest that Peter didn't write it, and that, in fact, it may have been written decades after Peter died. Now, if that's true, it's fair to have some disappointment about that and to have some questions. But we can't just throw it away, since this is something that the early Christians saw as representing the truth and the power of their faith. A commentary by one New Testament professor, Dwight Peterson, suggests that this letter is part of a particular genre known as testaments, essentially writings that were presented as someone's final message to their people. Usually, Peterson says, these testaments weren't written by the actual historical figure. There might have even been a communal understanding that these were, in his words, exercises in historical imagination. Another New Testament scholar, Margaret Amer, views this passage through the lens of oral history. By the time that this letter had been written, the Transfiguration was a familiar story to the recipients of it. Amer writes, in retelling those stories, the author and the community become eyewitnesses with the three who ascended the mountain. With these insights in mind, we might think about this writer as someone who, yes, stepped into the shoes of Peter, but not solely to kind of get one over on his readers, but because he identified so strongly with the story that he felt like he really was there, that he was personally with Jesus on that mountain, and that he himself heard the voice of God. That in itself is an example for us of what it might mean to witness Jesus' glory and feel his touch here and now. We, like this writer, have to enter deeply into the story that's been given to us, telling it to ourselves and each other again and again, and dwelling with it, so we might also feel that we were there, that we too have seen God's glory. As the writer goes on, he seems to suggest something like this himself. So we have the prophetic message more fully confirmed, he writes. You will do well to be attentive to this as to a lamp shining in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts. This letter acknowledges that the readers may not be seeing the full visible glory of Christ, but instead are making their way through the world with all of its gloomy and cloudy spells. But that doesn't mean the light is gone. The message of the still living Christ is a lamp, and this message is meant to tide us over until the day dawns and the morning star rises in our hearts. That phrasing points us to the return of Christ, an idea that already may have been getting some pretty heavy pushback by the time that this letter was written. Peterson explains that many people were critical about the idea of Jesus returning because, of course, it hadn't happened yet, and things seemed to be the same as ever. Now, if that's how people felt then, how much more might we feel that way now, thousands of years removed from that mountaintop moment? But the writer of 2 Peter presses on anyway, insisting it is not a cleverly devised myth to believe in the coming of the Lord, but rather that it is connected with what happened on that mountain, where the honor and glory and belovedness of Jesus was on display. 2 Peter implies that we can believe Jesus is coming back in glory because that glory has already been seen and witnessed, and because word of it has been passed down and entrusted to us. So we wait. Moses, too, had to wait in order to hear the voice of God. Maybe not for thousands of years, but there were 6 full days mentioned in today's passage between when Moses is told to go to the mountain and when God speaks again. What did Moses even do or feel during those 6 days? After all, God didn't make a formal appointment or give Moses a calendar. For all Moses knew, he could have been stuck waiting there for years. Waiting is a part of relationship with God. What that waiting looks like will be different for all of us. Maybe we feel God intensely once or a few times in our life, and then feel like we have to wait quite a while for another experience. Maybe we have seasons or stretches of feeling spiritually full, only to come up to times where we feel absolutely parched. Or maybe we might feel like our whole lives are spent waiting to know God in the way that we long for. Regardless of the specifics, we all wait. None of us have constant access to the experience of God at the intensity or clarity we'd like. And yes, we can approach God at any time in prayer, but that doesn't mean God will work exactly like an on-demand television program. So we have the prophetic message more fully confirmed. You will do well to be attentive to this, as to a lamp shining in a dark place, until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts. This is language for a waiting people. People who are not only waiting for a decisive, tangible event, Jesus here once more, though I think that is a part of it, but it's also for people who are waiting for something to rise in our hearts, for something to happen inside us, the light of God permeating every part of who we are, expelling all fear and doubt, and bringing us into the deepest possible joy. We are not there yet, and neither were the recipients of possibly fake Peter's letter. But we do have a message in the scene of Transfiguration and in the story that's been handed to us, and that is something powerful. We have a message, and it can just maybe be the thing that holds us together in the struggle and in the waiting. Though, for it to have that effect, it seems like 2 Peter is telling us we actually need to pay attention to it, to make space for it in our lives. After all, the message is like a lamp. So we have to actually look in the lamp's direction to gain all of the possible benefits of its light. It may not be as bright as what the disciples saw on that mountaintop, but a lamp, hopefully, is bright enough that we can get done what we need to get done, find what we need to find, and see what we need to see. Still, maybe some of you are wondering if it's really enough. Is it enough to hold on to the message when what we might really want is to fall on the ground as Jesus dazzles us, or to feel Jesus touch us and say, "Do not be afraid"? Of course, there are ways Jesus still does both of those things here and now. Many people, including some of you in this room, have stories of God showing up. God showing up in the aftermath of loss, in a struggle against addiction, a struggle against perfectionism, in a hike, in a sunset, in your singing in the choir, in your cupped hands at the communion rail, in a friend or family member or stranger who takes on the role of Jesus and cares for you in a way that communicates, "Get up and do not be afraid." And yet, in spite of all those things, we still wait. Or if not wait, we fluctuate, feeling these highs and lows and in-betweens in our connection with God. But this puts us in very good company with the disciples who saw the Transfiguration but couldn't stay in it, who had to go back down the mountain and, at first, keep what they saw to themselves. Jan Richardson, a brilliant writer of blessings, wrote a blessing based on this passage called "When Glory, a Blessing for Transfiguration Sunday." And in the last lines, she prays, that when glory shines, we will bring it back with us, all the way, all the way, all the way down. In our times of waiting and downward descent, when we leave behind mountains of glory and experiences of God made clear, may we learn to hold on to the glory that we have seen or that has touched us. And if that seems to come up short, may we listen to the glory proclaimed by those voices that came before us and that we can now find in our scriptures. May we hold in our hearts that voice saying, "This is my Son, my beloved, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." May we hold that in our hearts, knowing that this declaration was not the end of a story or the end of God's revelation, but instead that it is something that should be opening us up to all the possibilities that Christ has for us today. Knowing that the love of the Father does not stop with the Son, but that we too are gathered up in it. Amen.